Oh no, I'm actually in northern Alberta.
Oh my god, wow. Okay, that's great.
Yeah, for sure. I'm definitely digging it, but I was wondering some of the artists that you were digging early on. Were there any records or key artists from your formative years that, you know, like really set you off on music?
Definitely, you know, like The Clash, Bad Brains, Black Flag, local bands like De Kreutzen, those are some that come to mind, and then later classical composers, you know? Yeah, I mean, I think all those bands were major influences on me. People like Shostakovich and, a lot of the classical people later, but in the early days, definitely, the hardcore scene and the punk bands, basically.
Yeah, that's cool. So it must have been really something for you to be playing with MC5 there. That must have been kind of surreal.
Yes! Well, they were the MC3 at that point, but yeah, it was amazing. Wayne Kramer is one of the great people in the world. His wife had heard us on the radio and invited us to open that show. Also amazing that the Sun Ra Orchestra was on the bill as well, though Sun Ra had died, but, you know, his band is being kept alive by Marshall Allen. So that was incredible. Yeah, yeah, very much.
So were there any, like, key record stores or venues as a young budding musician? Because there always seems to be that, you know, sort of, like, communal sort of a vibe where it's, like-minded people getting together. Was there anything like that, like stores or venues when you were young?
Definitely. I grew up in Madison, Wisconsin, which is not too far from Canada. And the key record store for us, the place that meant everything, was a place called Paradise Records on State Street. And I used to, because we didn't have a lot of money or disposable income, my buddy and I, Tony, would buy like a record a week, and one person would tape it and the other would keep the album, and we would alternate, so therefore we could get more music. But yeah, that place was kind of seminal for us. And also the venues, there was a lot of all ages shows. Then the big club in my hometown, which burned down in 2001, I think, was called OK's Corral, and we saw, you know, everybody there. And we also, you know, the all ages shows were at a neighborhood center called the Wilmar Neighborhood Center, where I played my first gig, as well as larger shows were at a place called Turner Hall. So yeah, it was amazing. I mean, no question.
Is that like DIY sort of like Legion Hall-esque?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the bigger bands were at Turner Hall, like Black Flag or the Minutemen. The smaller, every Friday and Saturday, I think, there were shows at the Wilmar Neighborhood Center, and those were totally DIY shows. Although some huge bands came there in the early days, like Husker Du and Sonic Youth and stuff. But yeah, that was where it was happening, and there was a lot happening for such a small town. But it was a college town, so there was a lot going on. So
were some of your early projects punk, kind of rooted in nature? Not to get too caught up in the whole taxonomy of music thing, but was it more in that vein as opposed to what you're doing now, which is, you know, more of like a flamenco, classical, sort of a folky thing?
Yeah, I guess so. I think the new record is pretty much a rock album, though, too, even though those songs are kind of folk songs. Yeah, it was more punk, definitely punk, yeah, the early days. Then I did go to conservatory for a couple years before dropping out, and I studied classical guitar. So that influenced me, changed, you know, where I was going with music. But I always maintained an affection, great love for rock music, especially the stuff from that time, especially like, you know, a lot of politically tinged music. Especially, you know, like I said, The Clash were a huge, huge monumental influence on me. So were, you know, bands like Bad Brains and stuff like that. So yeah, it all kind of fused together into the band that I developed. It's almost been 20 years now. Maybe it has. But we all come from like kind of very mixed up backgrounds, you know, with a lot of some classical and jazz roots, but also like every single one of us, I think, started out loving, you know, rock and that there's always an abiding affection for it, you know, so.
Yeah, for sure. And you're talking about some of the politically charged elements of the music you were digging earlier on. And I mean, that kind of materializes in your project now. I mean, targeting certain, you know, fascist ideologies, alt-right.
Right.
It seems derivative of that. So how cathartic was it to, you know, include that element in the project here? Because I imagine certain dynamics in the present world probably leading to some compounding frustrations there.
Yeah, no, it was great. I've had a real long-lasting fascination with the Spanish Civil War, the conflict itself, the people that fought it, the music of it. So it was a great opportunity. And then, you know, this project was started really like a year ago. We started actually playing these annual celebration of the Lincoln Brigade, which was the name of the American volunteers that went and fought, and we would learn these songs. And then about a year ago, the organization that kind of funded the record and would have us play, you know, we talked about doing an album of it for like new generations of listeners. And then Trump won. So it all kind of, you know, changed. Although I think these songs are timeless and the message of them is timeless. And the people that fought were represented diverse ideologies, you know, but it's kind of scary that some of this real overt fascism is coming back, and in a strange way, it doesn't surprise me that there was some kind of relationship, I suppose, between the last Lincoln Brigade veteran dying about a year or two ago and then the reemergence of this kind of really overt fascism. There was some sort of symbolism to that for me, you know, but it's nice to have the songs, you know, because they do kind of evoke this conflict and what it meant in a way that's much more visceral than anything you could read, you know, or anything like that. So.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good confluence because, like I was saying, I mean, it kind of touches on certain things that are happening in the modern day, but you're also tying it into something that has, you know, important historical significance. So, I mean,
right.
Those sort of two things there. And it's just an interesting background. I mean, you know, tens of thousands of volunteers coming out, more than 50 countries journeying to Spain to fight fascism. So I think
yeah.
It's sort of, it's almost like a call to arms nowadays, like maybe people from all over need to focus on this certain situation and galvanize the, you know, the core effort of the collective.
You touched on a very important theme, like the decline of a kind of internationalism that is maybe necessary nowadays because a lot of these things are similar and they're happening all over the world, you know, and even though it's particularly acute in the United States, you know, it's the reemerging in Europe. I'm sure there's forces in Canada too, although, you know, it's probably not as bad, but similar kinds of challenges, you know. So, yeah, I do think that was one of the most remarkable things about the Spanish Civil War was, you know, this kind of international response that was truly moving and truly kind of unprecedented, you know, especially because these were volunteers. They weren't called into service. They chose to go, sometimes, you know, risking their life to do so. So, and certainly risking their life in Spain. A lot of them, you know, are buried there. So yeah, it's they're moving songs and they're important songs, and I hope that we did them justice, you know, but I just wanted to introduce them to new generations and also to introduce the story, you know, so that, cause it's in danger. I don't know if it's in danger of being lost, but it's particularly relevant, you know, right now. And,
so is it just those, you know, certain stories that jump out to you and, you know, through your own perception, you like to, you know, turn it into music, or are you like sort of a historian and you like to kind of filter certain things like that through the scope of your perception and get people into it. Because one of the things with history and trying to, you know, impart that on certain people, some people maybe think, oh, it's too dry or it's too this or it doesn't jump off.
Yeah.
So are you, is that something you're conscious of, or you try to, you know?
No, it's just following my interest. I'm a writer as well. I'm a journalist. So I try to, you know, I like to just play music, but I also have other interests, so I like to find ways to bring those interests into kind of a whole. You know, and this project has been dear to me. I've written a lot of articles about the Spanish Civil War, and then met several of the veterans and became friendly with them. So it was very personal, but I do think sometimes, you know, it's just, you want to just write a song, but more and more lately I have tried to weave in, you know, other interests that I've had and try to see if it works. And this is a particular project because these songs, you know, they're all cover songs really, but they're kind of reimagined by us. And they really have grown on us. They're really special songs. They were originally recorded they've been recorded by many people, but Pete Seeger famously recorded them in the early 40s, and they're amazing versions, but it's just, you know, him on a banjo. And I also thought they worked in a different context, you know, and I wanted to present them that way, you know, with like a kind of a rock sound. So that's, you know, it was a strong motivation, and I've had an affection for this story and a kind of a desire, I suppose, to see it persevere in people's memories, you know, as a kind of moment of solidarity, you know, and a thinking beyond a kind of narrow scope that I think is needed right now, you know, in order to kind of confront some of these challenges that are reemerging, these sort of dark ghosts.
Yeah, and it's cool you're incorporating that element. You were talking about your experience as a journalist there and how much you've covered this. You know, the New York Times, New York Observer, a lot of big outlets.
Yeah.
There. And yeah, I mean, you got to hang out with the last survivor. Of
yeah,
that,
yeah.
Berg. So that was, I mean, died at 100 years old. So.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was an amazing guy. I mean, in fact, I remember I was just talking to my friend from the Lincoln Brigade Archives about that day because she was with me, my friend Marina Gard, who has been an amazing help in this project. I need to give her a shout out. But we spent the day with Del at his home in California, and it was quite remarkable because he was 99 then, and he lived with his wife, who was 95, on their own, even though, you know, they were pretty fragile, but managed it. And this was in a house he built himself high up in the Sierra Nevada Mountains in California, about 3 hours east of Berkeley. And it was just a really one of those days that you'll never forget, you know. The fact that he was, I don't know, it just felt so incredible, right? Like the last Lincoln Brigade volunteer, and here he was living alone with his wife. They did not have a lot of money, and living kind of precariously, but yet he was kind of independent and defiant and warm and laughing until the very end. You know, he's just a remarkable, remarkable human being. So, you know, I always carry that. Now, we wanted to honor him as well as the other vets I knew who were very special to me, particularly a guy named Maddie Mattson, a Finnish immigrant who was an ambulance driver in Spain. And I got to know him maybe the best of any of the vets. Yeah, it's sad that they're all gone now, and so I kind of felt like it was a little bit my duty to see that their memory, you know, persevered. And I especially wanted to introduce it to young people or younger people that might not know it, and it does have a resonance now, a profound one. So anyway, yeah, it was amazing. Getting to know those guys.
There's just a cool multiplicity to what you're talking about there, just the storytelling, because you're getting out, you know, your experiences as a journalist, and obviously the overriding, you know, Spanish Civil War is very, very important, but to also have that localized sort of understanding of one of those veterans, I mean, just brings mm-hmm. a real sort of varied effort to the project that I thought was cool.
Oh, great. Well, I'm glad. I'm glad you dug it. And yeah, no, it's a labor of love that I'm so happy with. I mean, the band played amazingly. Valina Brown, amazing singer from the Bay Area. And so we're doing a record release show in New York on October 4th, and Valina's going to be there. So it's kind of like the first time we've done it live since the, even though it's sort of a live record, it's, there was a lot of, you know, we did a lot in the studio too. It's not completely, and we make no bones about it. Particularly want to mention Martin Beese, the engineer Svengali of Barbez, who's recorded everything we've ever done, and is just a brilliant mixer, producer, friend, kind of enthusiast, champion. And so Martin and I worked a lot on shaping the record, even though the essential elements were live. We added other people and mixed it in a very, in a way that was like, kind of like, so it's kind of like a hybrid of a live album and a studio album, so.
Yeah, because there's a certain vitality when it's live off the floor, and Damon Whittemore kind of handling that, and, you know, credits with Paul McCartney and Andrew Bird in the past. But you were talking about Martin Beese there. I mean, that's another individual who, I mean, just what a legendary studio there.
Yeah.
And so many projects. Juan.
Totally.
But, like, people talk really highly about him, too, as well. Like, I interviewed Ev Gold from Cinema Cinema, and they had a lot of really cool experiences with Martin. He just seems like one of those producers who wants to capture, you know, the most authentic version of the artist and just really sort of gets the dynamic there.
Absolutely. I mean, he's certainly the fifth Beatle of Barbez and maybe of Cinema Cinema, too. I mean, I think a lot of people have a deep and really profound affection for Martin because he's also just such an incredible guide, you know, through this complex process of making a record. And I think there's no experience that I value more than just being in the studio with him. It's so fun too, and it's so challenging, and just to be bouncing off ideas with him, and I just trust his judgment so implicitly, and it's so, because it's, you know, it's such a subjective process, and you're always looking for, like, there's no right way to do it, but you're also looking for, to unearth the thing that you want to make, like a sculpture or something. And so it's in those conversations and that dialogue with Martin that the thing kind of emerges, and his ideas and, you know, and his views. I just take them so seriously, and I respect him so much. I can't imagine really working with anyone else. So anyway, yeah, I'm a number one fan of Mr. Beese. He's really the best. But then again, I have a limited perspective, but I do think he's an exceptional person, and certainly has been just an amazing presence in Barbez and in my own. I'm working on a separate project with just my drummer, John. It's called John and Dan. And we've been doing some sporadic recording at Martin's, and that's, you know, it's just been so great, you know, similar, you know, it's just great, you know. So anyway, yeah.
Big yeah, fan. The John and Dan outfit there is supposed to be working on a debut album there. I mean, you guys in Barbez put out a record recently, obviously, so maybe the John
yes.
and Dan put on the
yeah.
back burner a little bit. So is there any updates?
It was.
On that?
Yeah, hopefully by next year. I'm also working on a book, so
right on.
Which is my journalistic life, and that is really the thing that I'm mainly working on.
Yeah.
But as soon as that is done, and that is going to be out next year. It's about Wisconsin politics. But definitely. The John and Dan record is about half done. We've mixed half of it. We just have to hole up for a while and write the rest of the record. But yeah, it's been on hold a little bit just out of sheer busyness. But we both are just itching to get back to it and kind of and finish the record with Martin and you know, so anyway, we'll keep you posted. We did have a really nice tour in Spain and Portugal last year. It happened to be over the election though, so it was a bit bizarre in the end. I mean, part of it was before, part of it was after. So it was tinged. But yeah, no. John and I are anxious to get back to it. So.
Yeah, it seems like a really comprehensive project. I mean, we're talking about Martin BC and what he brings to the table as well. But I thought it was cool that there was some extensive liner notes that were written by an award-winning author recently published a groundbreaking history of the Spanish Civil War. So I just thought it was a really comprehensive sort of effort on multiple fronts there. So how did that aspect of the project come about?
Well, Adam Hochschild is an amazing writer, a historian. He's written about the Belgian Congo, famously a book called King Leopold's Ghost. And he wrote recently a very excellent book on the Spanish Civil War called Spain in Our Hearts, Americans in the Spanish Civil War, 1936 to 1939. And he was helped a lot in that process, the research process, by ALBA, the group that funded the record. And I had the idea, and I met Adam a couple times, and I've written about the Spanish Civil War, so we exchanged friendly notes. And so Marina asked, I thought maybe it would be nice if he would write the liner notes, and he was totally open to it and did a beautiful job. And it was just nice to have his voice as part of the project, you know. But he is a great writer, and we were really super honored to have his, participation in it. So, that's pretty much how it came about. All the people asked him, and he accepted.
Oh, that's cool. And it seems like, yeah, overall the reviews have been pretty positive so far. I mean, the New Yorker and Pitchfork putting out some positive words, and Bob Moore.
Well, that's, those are previous, those are about the band previously. We haven't, the new record hasn't been reviewed by those places yet, but it's not yet out, so hopefully. But yeah, no, over the years, we've been at it a long time, and we've, you know, kind of garnered a few accolades along the way, and very grateful for them, and we'll just, you know, keep doing what we do. Hopefully it will be reviewed by Pitchfork. I don't know. I mean, we're a funny band in that we don't really fit into any, real specific genre. You know, it's kind of, you know, it's just a mixture of styles and inspirations and sort of hard to define music. It doesn't fit easily into any genre, so sometimes we fall between the cracks, you know, as far as coverage goes, but we're grateful that that we've been appreciated you know, in whatever way we have over the last 20 years. So anyway, yeah, but
yeah, I get what you mean. It's sort of like this nebulous kind of niche that you have, but like some of the bands you've played with, like, you know, like Godspeed You Black Emperor,
yeah. Yeah.
Angels, Flight, and sort of things, yeah, like that. Like, you could see why these certain outfits would be
mm-hmm.
on a billing,
yeah,
together, but at the same time, you can't put like a taxonomy sort of like tag across and be like, oh, this is this kind of music or whatever.
Right, exactly. And those bands spiritually are very close to us, and even sometimes musically.
Yeah.
And I love Swans and, you know, and Godspeed. We played with them on their first tour, you know, and we've also
That's
played,
very cool.
And they definitely come closer than most to what we do. You know, and bands like Sleepy Time, Gorilla Museum, I don't know if you know them, they're from the Bay Area. And some of the, like, Ipecac stuff, like Secret Chiefs, slightly, you know. But everybody, you know, those bands, too, are doing their own thing, really. So it's like, you know, the weird stuff. And then certainly John Zorn, you know, who's been such an amazing friend and champion of the band, you know, he put out two of our records, and you know, that world of the downtown New York stuff, like Elliot Sharp, they've been supportive, even if we're not particularly improvising band, although some of the guys in it do come from that background, but we've always had a warm welcome, you know, in the downtown scene. So yeah, we kind of cross certain fences, but it's all, you know, it's all good, and New York has always been a place where, like, there's a lot of weird bands, you know, doing different things, sometimes, you know, somewhat esoteric like ours, but sometimes esoteric with a kind of, I don't know, purpose to it that we try to, you know, imbibe in our music, as a lot of other people do too, you know, so yeah, So it's been always a very tolerant place for experimentation.
Yeah, for sure. And that new album coming out October 6th there, I thought it was cool that there's multiple options for, you know, physical copies of it, CD or vinyl. Was there a...
Yes!
Was there a particular focus on wanting it on vinyl in the sense of getting the most comprehensive sort of, you know, the mastered sound out there to people? Because vinyl, more often than not, can capture that sort of sound. And what you guys bring to the table is fairly nuanced in as far as, like, the layers of sound that you guys... build upon. So was that a conscious thing to want to...
It wasn't so much as far as an audiophile thing. I just think that's where people are at right now with vinyl.
Yeah, yeah.
And Important Records, the label that put it out, they said, you know, I really suggest we do this on vinyl too, because that's what people pay attention to now. And I was happy. I love vinyl. So
yeah.
It was no problem. It wasn't so much thinking about the audio issues, although... I do appreciate the warmth and the depth of the record on vinyl. So yeah, I do, I think it was just like, that's where people are at, you know, which is a good thing. And the label suggested it as a way to, you know, make sure that the record got some attention, you know, so.
Yeah, yeah, that's a very good point there. Just not coming from the, yeah, the audiophile thing so much. It's just more of the, I guess, like, tactile sort of fascination.
Yeah, that's what people want to pay attention to, releases that are on vinyl. Although, it is definitely a side benefit, you know, that
yeah,
it's
yeah.
on... That sounds so nice on vinyl. So, yeah, we're happy. And then the design, I was really happy with this amazing artist, Chippy Hern Chin, who does a lot of John Zorn stuff. She did the artwork, and... the images are from Robert Capa. He was a famous, you know, wartime journalist, and he was in Spain. That was really his first kind of beat. And this amazing museum, the International Center of Photography, let us use a couple of the images for the artwork, and I was just really happy with how it came out. So, and credit to her, because she's just a really miraculous artist.
Yeah, and recording the album live at the Fan Society in 2016, and just the project seems cool in the sense that Abraham Lincoln Brigade, there's going to be a certain, you know, donation, like proceeds from the record will be going to just alleviating certain stresses and whatnot. So yeah, it seems like a very cool project, and a lot of people who are very tied to what happened in the Spanish Civil War, and they have a certain, you know, awareness of that, and they want to get the message across, but at the same time also bringing their unique talents and sort of perspectives to the table.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully it will, and it does, you know. And I did want to, you know, one of the motivations for the record was definitely to get the word out about the Abraham Lincoln Brigade Archives, which does an amazing job. It's a nonprofit that tries to teach the legacy of the volunteers to high school students so that people think about, like, how, you know, there's moral choices in their own time. And the Lincoln Brigade obviously faced an exceptionally difficult time, but what they did was really remarkable, their response to it. So I think it opens up the possibility for people to kind of think about what it means to view someone else's suffering as your own, you know, and just thinking about the legacy of the Lincoln Brigade in terms of that is a very powerful thing, and you know, this organization keeps that spirit alive for people and reminds people and preserves, you know, does many practical functions too, like preserves the papers and the artifacts of the Lincoln Brigade, but also is trying to transfer that legacy to new generations. Like, they have a human rights film festival that's going on in New York just next week. So transferring the kind of ideals of the Lincoln Brigade to contemporary issues is one of their goals and their achievements. So.
And the Abraham Lincoln Brigade Archives is another important sort of nonprofit outfit there, because it gave you certain opportunities to use pieces of interviews all throughout the record, which I thought added a very cool touch.
Yeah, yeah. No, they did. And they helped us every step of the way. I mean, they, you know, funded the record and were super supportive of it. In fact, you know, so And they were incredibly generous with that material too. Like that interview from on the first track is from one that they conducted, and which I wanted to use. So.
Yeah, but it's a really cool record for sure. A lot of people coming from different outfits. Like I thought it was cool that Peter from Shearwater was laying down some bass on the record, and Danny from The Queen had a feature there. But yeah, just a really cool project all around. Is there anything you wanted to add as we're sort of wrapping up here?
I mean, I'm just grateful for the interview. Hopefully we'll make it to Canada one day again. We played in Montreal many times. Actually, at the Casa, you know, Godspeed's kind of like home. And I do think, hope people enjoy the music as well as the kind of, sentiment behind it to maybe make people aware of this and also sort of hopefully inspire some people to think about what's going on in their own time and try to formulate a response to some of the things that are not going well, you know. So I think that's it. Yeah, I'm grateful to you for the interview. Thank you. And glad you dug the record.
No, I mean, I think it's a cool effort. I mean, if we're not aware of certain things in our past that could be, you know, insidious or negative in some sort of way, I think we could potentially repeat it unwittingly. So I think it's an important sort of thing that you're doing.
Yes. Well, grateful to you for mentioning that. And yes, it is a fear that we'll repeat some of the worst moments in history. And there's certainly some troubling things that are happening now that need to be responded to, you know, so.
But yeah, I mean, really cool project again, and you've been really great with your time. Super appreciate that. And yeah, I'll be linking up everyone who's relevant to it. I'll let Howard know when the article's coming out.
That would be awesome, yeah. Yeah, well, thank you, Dylan. And you'll send Howard a link. And if you need anything else, just don't hesitate to hit me up on the cell, okay?
All right, cool, man. Yeah, super appreciate that.
Okay, terrific. Best of luck to you. Okay.
All right, thank you.
Thanks a lot.